Welcome to New Narrative's Southeast Asia Dispatches. I'm your host, Bonibel Ramatan, Editorial Manager for New Narrative. New Narrative is a movement to democratize democracy in Southeast Asia, and this podcast is one of the ways we attempt to do just that. Transparency and accountability and historical awareness are some of the most important pillars of democracy. Historical revisionism, where you're basically rewriting history by hiding the facts, denying what happened, washing the blood off your hands, and propagating a different version of the truth, is an affront to all of those values. And enforced disappearances, where the police or military or paramilitary forces knock on your door and kidnap you, has always been the bedrock of such revisionism. It's kind of obvious when you say it out loud, but when a country makes their people disappear with no explanation, that country is probably not a very healthy democracy. Enforced disappearances is what made Indonesia what it is today. How we got away with practically genocide in the last century, and are still getting away with kidnap activists as recent as 20-odd years ago. Some journalists would even go as far as to argue that Indonesia practically invented enforced disappearances. But Indonesia by no means has a monopoly on the practice. According to data from the Families of Victims of Involuntary Disappearance, or FIND, as of June 2023, there have been over 2,000 documented cases of enforced disappearances in the Philippines since the implementation of martial law in the early 70s. Of this total, 1,165 people are still missing. 663 have been found alive, and 280 have been discovered dead. And that's only the ones recorded.
Hello, my name is Wulan Kusuma Wardani.
That is Wulan Kusuma Wardani, a freelance journalist based in Jakarta writing on human rights, criminal codes, and gender issues. Her writings have been published by Magdalene, Coconuts, Rest of World, and the Jakarta Post. At the end of last year, she published an article in New Narrative on enforced disappearances in Indonesia and the women who are affected.
My name is Celia Sevilla.
That is Celia Sevilla from Asian Federation Against Involuntary Disappearances, or AFAD. Her uncle, Hermon C. Luckman, was a labor and human rights lawyer forcibly disappeared in 1977 during Ferdinand Marcos Sr.'s martial law regime. She is now an executive council member of AFAD. In this episode, we will talk about enforced disappearances in Indonesia and the Philippines, mechanisms for dealing with enforced disappearances, and as usual, what kind of regional solidarity we need to tackle this issue. Thank you so much for being here, Wulan and Celia. Why don't we start with Wulan, since we have published your article. It was about, you know, enforced disappearances, but in the Indonesian context. So can you talk a bit about the article and about the history of enforced disappearances in Indonesia?
As you might know, that Indonesia has a shamelessly long history of enforced disappearances cases. In every human rights abuse, there have been victims of enforced disappearance. This includes, among others, the 1965-1966 tragedy, and then Tanjung Priok massacre. It occurred in 1982. Other cases such as the 1982-1985 mysterious shooting, or commonly known as Petrus, the abbreviation of Penembakan Misterius. And then other cases such as Talang Sari tragedy, it occurred in 1980. And the most widely known is the 1997-1998 activist kidnapping. And other cases took place in Papua, such as Wasior and Wamena. And also Rumah Gedong cases, it took place in Aceh. So what is the similarity of those cases? It's the perpetrator. The main perpetrators are always military personnel and police officers. And who are the victims? Well, they came from different backgrounds. I'll give you some example. During the 1965-1966 tragedy, it was a large-scale extrajudicial killing, and the main target was people who were accused of being affiliated with the Communist Party. They were, among others, the leaders of the grassroots organizations, political party members and local officials. Meanwhile, individuals who were forcibly disappeared in 1997-1998 were mainly political party members, activists, students, and grassroots organizations. However, people who were neither activists nor politicians were fell victims too. For example, in 1985, I mentioned Bahtiar Johan in my article. He was a trader who was forcibly disappeared when attended a protest in Tanjung Priok in North Jakarta. And then one of 13 people who was forcibly disappeared in 1997-1998 was Ismail. Ismail is a driver who drove Dedi Hamdun and Noval Al-Khatiri. Dedi Hamdun and Noval Al-Khatiri were business people and also politicians from the United Development Party. They were in the same car before eventually kidnapped. I think Ismail was kidnapped too because he was the key witness in this case. And then many people, of course, might wonder what are the motives behind these atrocities. Based on what I have read so far, there are at least three motives. First, the enforcer's appearance was used to speed up the transition of power. As I mentioned earlier, during the 1965-1966 tragedy, the state apparatus hunted down people who were accused of being affiliated with the Communist Party. According to the Indonesian Human Rights Commission, or Komnas HAM, around 32,774 people forcibly disappeared during that tragedy. What are the other motive is to smooth the investment and maintain territorial integrity and sovereignty. During the Suharto administration, the state handed out a huge concessions to big corporations, and any challenges from local communities and human rights defenders, such as in Aceh and Papua, were met with repressive measures by the security state apparatus. Rumah Gedong in Aceh, for example, was a military post widely known as the site of torture, arbitrary detainment, and killing of 100 civilians accused of being linked to the Free Aceh movement. Another motive behind the enforced disappearance is to maintain power and silent dissent, especially during the Suharto regime. One of the most widely known examples is the 1997-1998 kidnapping. 23 people were abducted, one person found dead, 9 were released, and 13 other still missing. Despite the several human rights violations that I have mentioned previously, only Tanjung Priok was prosecuted. I have not mentioned the human rights abuse in East Timor, Paniai, and Abipura, which took place after the fall of Suharto. But these cases were also taken to human rights courts. The result, well, unfortunately, the defendants were acquitted. How about the other cases? Komnas HAM has so far conducted inquiries into 12 cases and submitted its findings to the Attorney General Office. But the Attorney General always says that they don't have any sufficient evidence to bring those cases to the Human Rights Court. So that's my explanation.
Thank you. I mean, we have as you just mentioned, but also in your article, we have such a vast history of enforced disappearances. In fact, I think Vincent Bevins, wasn't it, who mentioned that we serve as a model, actually, for enforced disappearances that would eventually also, specifically the 65, anti-communist killings and anti-communist disappearances served as a model to be replicated all around the world, which is scary if you think about it, but also a pivotal event in Indonesia that we have not acknowledged. We have acknowledged, but haven't really followed up much to this day. Celia, I wanna get to you though. Was this also happening in your country? Was the patterns and the history, was it similar? And could you talk a bit about the history? And I know your uncle was involved in I think around the 70s, around the late 70s. So can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, so there were really massive and systematic commission of enforced disappearances in the Philippines under the martial law regime of Marcos Sr. And as I mentioned earlier, my uncle was one of the victims. He was just 32 years old, and he was a labor and human rights lawyer during that time. And he was disappeared along with a labor leader as they were just simply waiting for a public ride to go to a meeting. And during the time of Ferdinand Marcos Sr., there were at least a total of 2,567 victims. But we know that this is really very much a case of underreporting, because the witnesses and the families are afraid of retaliation. And we know this for a fact because even as recent as a few years ago, when we hold photo exhibits, there would be people who would approach us and tell us that their families were victims during the time of martial law, but would rather not have the cases documented up to this day. So yes, the same thing happened, and also the causes are basically the same as what Wu Lan has outlined. It really is being done to stifle political dissent and immobilize political activists and human rights defenders, to silence the political opponents or even eliminate them, and ensure the political survival of those in power. So basically the same root causes, you know, to suppress resistance as well. The cases of disappearance also spiked during the all-out war against terror. After martial law, this was during the time of Corazon Aquino already. And of course, it's also a way for the state to sow terror and fear in the community, more particularly in areas that are identified to be influenced by rebels or armed groups.
Yeah, and I understand that, you know, again, you mentioned this, there's a personal dimension to you, for you, around all of this. Well, and for the other, the families, for the other families of the other victims, some of them choose not to be documented, but you chose to take this path of activism, of going out to the public. Can you tell us more about that decision and what made you, and how do you feel really about all of these cases?
Well, we know we really cannot afford to not speak out, because while speaking out may be dangerous, silence kills. And especially now, during these times, Bonnie, dire as the situation is in Indonesia in this regard, at least there is some acknowledgement, as you said, a level of acknowledgement that enforced disappearances did take place. So it is still a step ahead of the Philippines, and it is a crucial step, because lamentably here in our country, the president does not even acknowledge the enforced disappearance cases that were committed during martial law. According to him, the plunder, the massive corruption, and human rights violations did not happen during his father's 20-year rule. So, you know, as I said, there's my uncle and the other labor leader, Victor Reyes. They both remain disappeared to this day, along with at least 620 others whose cases have been documented by FIND. And as I said, there must be so many more that are unreported and undocumented. So is Marcos Jr. now saying that they never existed? And there is no denying that enforced disappearance was committed massively and systematically during his father's dictatorship. And we have to counter the active historical revisionism that is going on now, that they started long before Marcos Jr. ran for the presidency. Because really, education and heightening people's awareness are crucial to the fight to put an end to enforced disappearance. And so for us now, especially for our family, this is not just a human rights advocacy, it is a family crusade for us. Because if we cannot get justice for my uncle, for our disappeared loved ones in court, since the main body of evidence is missing, which is the person himself, then perhaps we can at least get justice by continuing the fight for the kind of society that they sacrificed their lives and liberty for.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's really admirable. What is it exactly, though? How do you do it? How do you go about it? What do you do in AFAD, in the organization? How do you fight for this amidst the, when the government doesn't even acknowledge it?
So just a quick introduction to what the Asian Federation Against Involuntary Disappearance is. So it is a federation of human rights organizations working on the issue of enforced disappearance across Asia. So it was founded here in Manila, Philippines in June 1998, initially with only 3 member organizations. So that's FIND, and then the Association of Parents of Disappeared Persons in Kashmir, and the Organization of Parents and Family Members of the Disappeared in Sri Lanka. Today, AFAD has 13 member organizations from 10 countries, and also 3 individual members, 2 from Switzerland and 1 from Laos. So as a federation, AFAD's mission is really to work for the attainment of truth, justice, redress, and the reconstruction of the historical memory of the disappeared. It actively participates in the struggle for social transformation because this is absolutely necessary in order to realize a world without desaparecidos. In order to attain this mission, AFAD strives to promote and forge international solidarity among organizations of the families of the disappeared in Asia, as well as with similar formations in other continents, such as FEDEFAM in Latin America, and because these other formations actually inspired the establishment of AFAD. AFAD also works to provide assistance to member organizations in ensuring a stronger response to the phenomenon of enforced disappearance, and conduct campaign and lobby work to address the issue of enforced disappearance in Asia, as well as strengthen the capacity of the Federation itself, as well as its member organizations through various forms of empowerment and capacity building activities. So it has 4 main pillars of work to achieve these objectives. First is research and documentation, then psychosocial support and accompaniment, advocacy, and we have, of course, institutional strengthening.
Thank you. There's a lot that I want to go into there later. But Wulan, you're coming at this from the angle of a journalist. So, you know, it's quite different when you are when you're running an organization and you have like a personal thing about it, and you're coming at this from the angle of the journalist. You know, and also tying it back to Jokowi's campaign and so on. I guess it's a couple of questions, right? First of all, what gets you interested in this topic? Why do you care so much about this issue? And what makes you choose to actually write about that topic now during, you know, very close to the elections? As you did mention, it is an issue that got brought up in the last election cycle. So can you talk more about that?
You asked me why I am interested in writing about these issues, because I think not many people know what happened, especially during the Suharto regime. That's why I chose to write about the enforced disappearance issues, and I conducted interview with the family member, all females, because I mean the editor told me that why don't you write with the gender perspective, because as we know that most people who are forcibly disappeared are males, but those who feel the negative impact are mainly women. So that's the reason why I chose to write about these issues. And in generally, I'm also interested in human rights issues. Well, since forever.
I guess the second part of that question also, how do you think this relates to the current political atmosphere in Indonesia? Because it was part of the promise for Jokowi's campaign. But we're not really hearing about it anymore.
Okay. Yeah, in 2014 and 2019, Jokowi promised to solve the human rights abuse cases. And as we know that his only move was when he acknowledged and regretted the 12 incidents of human rights violation, including the enforced disappearance cases in 1997-1998. Like Celia said, that Indonesia is one step ahead of the Philippines. But yeah, it's true. However, even though President Jokowi has formally acknowledged and expressed his regret over 12 gross human rights violations, the civil society organization still not satisfied with this policy, because although Jokowi has ordered ministers and ministerial level official to take measure in implementing a recommendation for non-judicial resolution, there's no guarantee that the perpetrators will be brought before the court. I have to mention what is the non-judicial resolution. The example of non-judicial resolution for the victims is the access to healthcare and the scholarship for the families of the victims. And it includes the easing of the regulation of obtaining visa for those who went to exile after the 1965 tragedy. Still, like I have mentioned earlier, there's no guarantee that the perpetrators will be brought before the court.
So are there currently any ongoing advocacies to do that? Are the current demands... Yeah, what are the current demands of the current advocacies? Is it to bring them to court or...?
Yes, various civil society organizations have continued to urge the government to resolve serious human rights violations through judicial means. Yeah, even though the government has tried to provide remedies to the victims, many activists argue that it's not enough. Last year, I remember that an activist told me that the reparation for the victims of the gross human rights violations should have included the right to the truth. What I mean by the right to the truth is that the relatives of the victims have the right to know what happened to them. Regarding the 1997-1998 kidnapping, in 2009, the Indonesian Parliament, based on the 2006 finding of Komnas HAM, recommended that the president establish an ad hoc human rights court to try those suspected of committing enforced disappearance in 1997-1998, but it hasn't materialized. And then another issue is the importance of the ratification of the International Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearance. The civil society has also urged the government to ratify this convention. Sadly, the deliberation process of the ratifying this convention has been stalled. Why is it important to ratify this bill? Because it provides states with a solid legal framework in the area of prevention, punishment, reparation, and non-recurrence of enforced disappearance. So I think there is no valid excuse to not ratify this convention.
Thank you. Celia, are you aware of any similar ongoing advocacies in the Philippines or in other countries in the region? Because AFAD works with a lot of countries and with varying states, right? With various states of like some of them, yeah, like Indonesia, we've acknowledged the thing, but we haven't really processed them judicially, while the Philippines really have not, you know, is still denying that it exists. Can you talk about your work specifically in AFAD and how you... Because you did mention education and psychosocial support and stuff like that. Can you talk about these activities that you're doing in relation to the regional work and the differences between various countries?
Wulan mentioned the International Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearance. AFAD was actually, at least its member organizations, were able to participate in the drafting of this convention. And we are all working towards its universal ratification. The funny thing is, here in the Philippines, we already have, because the international convention, it of course, like all other treaties, obliges the state to enact a domestic legislation that is a counterpart of the convention. Now, here in the Philippines, we already have an anti-enforced or involuntary disappearance law. After 16 long years of steadfast lobby by the families of the disappeared by FIND and the human rights community, especially those who belong to the Coalition Against Enforced Disappearance, or CAED, which FIND spearheaded. So this is a group of human rights organizations that also lobbied for the passage of the Anti-Enforced Disappearance Act. When I think this is the first and only special law on enforced disappearance in Asia, and it is very similar to the convention in a lot of ways, because the convention entered into force 2 years before this law was enacted. But let me be clear, though, that the convention and the act are not in any way identical. They are complementary and mutually reinforcing. Now, the funny thing is, we have not ratified the convention yet. So the enactment of the law preceded the ratification or the accession to the convention. When we were lobbying for the ratification of the convention, we were told by the former Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs that we must establish the domestic mechanism first in order to ensure compliance with the convention. And then when we were already able to lobby successfully for the enactment of the law, we were told we no longer need to ratify the convention because we already have the law. So we always say that they cannot, you know, replace each other. They are there to be supportive of each other, because there are many provisions also in the convention that, for example, victims would not have access to the Committee on Enforced Disappearance if we are not a state party to it. And the member organizations of AFAD are also trying to get their respective states to accede to this convention, as well as have national laws on enforced disappearance enacted. In Pakistan, there has been some progress. To my knowledge, it is not a separate law, but a revision of their penal code, so that enforced disappearances are penalized. But amid the state's denial of the commission of enforced disappearances, thereby perpetuating impunity, it is really imperative for human rights organizations, not just the member organizations of AFAD, and even individual human rights defenders, to actively lobby for the state to accede to the convention, as well as for the national government to enact a law penalizing enforced disappearance. Now, if the concerned state is already a party to the convention or has already passed an anti-disappearance law, then civil society should advocate relentlessly for the full and strict implementation of both the international and domestic laws. Wulan earlier mentioned that acknowledgement would not necessarily lead to change. And that is true, you know. Even if we have the legislation, if it is barely implemented, then, you know, the law is only as good as its implementation. In the event that the calls for these are unheeded within the national jurisdiction, aside from reporting cases of enforced disappearance to the UN Working Group on Enforced or Involuntary Disappearances, complaints may also be submitted to the Human Rights Committee, which is the body of, I think, 18 independent experts that monitors the implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights by its state parties. And then if the national human rights institution truly and effectively performs its mandate, then concerned CSOs may also request the NHRI to conduct investigations into the enforced disappearance cases, and subsequently, if warranted, join other stakeholders, particularly the surface victims and their families, in filing alternative complaints with the appropriate judicial or quasi-judicial bodies. And in case the national human rights institution has prosecutorial powers, then it can also motu proprio hear the case or cases. And then these legal actions may also be accompanied by meta-legal actions, such as we are familiar with these, the mass mobilizations, protest rallies, public fora, people's courts, and heightened multimedia campaigns, educational discussions in schools, universities and communities, engagements with the church, truth-telling sessions with victims, holding various forms of memorialization. So these are some of the things that AFAD and its member organizations do to heighten awareness of the issue of enforced disappearance and drum up support for its eradication. And in the conduct of these metal legal activities, it is important to highlight the causes of enforced disappearance that are rooted in societal injustices and human rights violations, which inevitably lead to dissent, in turn eventually leading to the forcible stifling of dissent through enforced disappearance, among other unjust means and abuse of authority. It is really essential, Bonnie, to expose and unearth these roots, the injustices and violations, in order to catalyze the growing of a new society that is just, where human rights are truly protected, promoted, and fulfilled. Or in other words, a society where the dream of ending enforced disappearance may finally come to fruition.
Yeah, in your experience, what has been the most effective to get people talking, and especially, if possible, like to get the, you know, state apparatuses, state politicians starting to actually acknowledge this, or like moving in the right direction? What's been most effective and what's been most challenging?
So in my experience, really, it is the convergence of the civil society. They have different roles that they play in dealing with enforced disappearances and, of course, other human rights violations. And these actions may be preventive, investigative, prosecutorial, penal, and or reparative. So they have different but interrelated mandates and functions. So there are lawyer groups, those that provide psychosocial support, health and medical care providers, and also those like AFAD and FIND and other member organizations of AFAD that have multiple functions such as search and documentation, national and international advocacy, research and publishing materials, education, livelihood support even, and legal assistance. But while these CSOs have all these different and equally important roles that each one specializes in, there is one powerful role that all CSOs can play. And in my experience, that is storytelling. The diversity of CSOs is an advantage, as the stories can be told then from different perspectives. And these stories are instrumental in connecting to people and helping them understand and appreciate the value of the cause we are fighting for. So for me, we must keep on telling stories, putting a human face on enforced disappearance. I remember what my uncle, my disappeared uncle, his younger brother, who's a labor leader who was shot dead also by unknown assailants, he used to say, "Talk to as many as you can. If you convince even just one single person to support your cause, consider that a victory." So this is why, aside from the various roles that civil society organizations regularly perform, I hope that we all tell stories and keep the memory of our disappeared loved ones alive in one way or another. Let us keep connecting the past with the present, as this will accelerate the realization of societal change towards the kind of future that our desaparecidos worked so hard for.
Yeah, thank you. That's powerful. Wulan, do you have any thoughts on this in your own experience and reporting and while talking to the families? What has been most powerful? What has been most effective to them? What has been most helpful to them, to the cause?
Celia mentioned about keep talking about these issues in order that people will know more about this. I remember that an Indonesian author called Leila Kudori has written historical fiction book called Laut Bercerita. In English version, The Sea Speaks His Name. Leila wrote this book because she was inspired by the 1997-1998 enforced disappearance case. The book illustrates how a group of students forcibly disappeared and how their family suffered because they didn't know their whereabouts. And I think this novel is good for those who want to start learning about these issues because the author conducted interviews with the survivors of the 1997-1998 kidnapping. And then Celia also mentioned about education. Yeah, I think it is also important to educate ourselves. First of all, educate ourselves. Because as I mentioned repeatedly, not so many people knows about what happened, especially during the Suharto administration. And then I don't know if it is possible if it is possible for the civil society organization to collaborate with schools to, I don't know how to say it, to organize a non-formal human rights education, because events like enforced disappearance and other human rights violations in Indonesia are not written in the history books. That's the problem, unfortunately. And then I remember that in August last year, at a discussion held at the Amnesty International Indonesia office, several academicians, historians, and activists called for rewriting of Indonesian history, particularly related to the 1965 and 1966 tragedies, and the inclusion of severe human rights violation cases in the official national history. This is really important, I think, but in my view, it will take a long time to materialize.
Oh, why do you feel that's the case? I guess it also leads to my next question. What has been the biggest challenge of doing this?
The biggest challenge would be, I think, the government and the army, because as we know that the main perpetrators of these human rights violations are police officers and military personnel. That's why I said that it will take a long time to materialize. Still, there's a resistance inside the army, undeniably.
Yeah. When you spoke to the sources that you interacted with for your article, were they fearful? Were they hesitant to speak up? Were they afraid of possible backlash, or were they actually eager to share the stories?
Last year, when I conducted interview with my sources, I didn't see that they felt afraid. I think they are all very open. They have been invited to talk in various discussions, and there was one source that I talked to. She was Miss Yeti, Wanma Yeti. She was the chief of the ICOHI, the association of the victims of enforced disappearance. And well, I think if you ask me were they feel afraid, I think they don't feel afraid anymore to speak openly about their cases.
I see. Yeah. Because that's kind of like what I thought as well, right? There's a lot of hesitation to actually push and like really speak up and demand to the government. But when you speak to the people that are most affected themselves, they are, a lot of them are eager to speak up. Is this also true in your experience, Celia? And were you personally like ever afraid, or have you ever gotten like harassed by or threatened by the government or things like that?
Personally, no. I haven't really experienced such in relation to my work on enforced disappearance. I did experience a bit of, I guess, harassment when I was talking about human rights defenders more in the current situation. A high-ranking official of government described our event as pathological lying at its finest, something like that. You know? And this was at the UN. It was a parallel event to a session of the Human Rights Council. And his post was shared hundreds of times over, and the people were saying things like, we should be surveilled or tortured or things like that. But it never really anything more serious.
I see. Yeah, that's still pretty horrible. I'm sorry you went through that. But I'm glad that there hasn't, you know, it hasn't really ever escalated into, you know, very serious or threatening conditions for you and for the rest of the, hopefully for the rest of the advocates of the issue, I'm hoping. That's also, you know, something very peculiar about this historical revisionism in general. Enforced disappearances is a big part of historical revisionism in Southeast Asia, right? Because it's like a lot of the time, people just don't really, not only that people don't know or people don't understand, but there's, at least in Indonesia, one of the, without naming any names, but like one of the bigger political parties, one of the more popular political parties in Indonesia, and I guess it has been an injunction for quite a long time, it's really like pushing us to, you know what, let's just move on, right? That's like the whole thing is about moving on. And I'm like, well, you just, you know, you don't talk about the past anymore, you don't talk about history anymore. And it's like there's a lot of a sense of like, why should we care about, I mean, this has happened in the past, right? Why do we need to care? But as you mentioned before, we have the right to the truth, right, Wulan? You said that victims should have, one of the forms of repatriation, victims should know what actually happened. The families of victims has the right to know what happens. So I guess this leads to the ending part, the concluding part of our discussion. With all of these things considered, with all of these things that we've been discussing so far, it is very, very important to acknowledge the truth, especially because the victims of the families are still here. We still need the truth. We have the right to do, you know, we have the right to actually know. The nation, like the region, the world has the right to know. But what can we actually do about it, right? If we are maybe, you know, we just here listening to this podcast, for example, or we have a CSO, as you mentioned, yeah, CSOs can really help tell stories. But also, aside from that, what can we actually do? What kind of solidarity do we need to build here that you feel would be impactful?
Okay, I would say, again, education is really important for us to be able to expand our knowledge about these issues. Civil society organization need to collaborate again with academic institution to keep spreading knowledge about these problems. They can, for example, organize discussions with the presence of the families of the victims. And then second, we can attend a protest demanding our government to resolve these issues. And I don't know if there's any regular protests to demand justice for the victims of human rights abuses in other Southeast Asian countries. But in Indonesia, there's a protest called Aksi Kamisan. Kamis in Indonesian means Thursday. And so Kamisan is a peaceful movement held every Thursday by human rights victims, their family, and activists demanding for justice. It has been held every Thursday since 19 January 2007 in front of the presidential palace. This movement is inspired by the Association Madres de Plaza de Mayo, an association of Argentine mothers whose children were forcibly disappeared during the dirty war of military dictatorship in 1976-1983.
Yeah. Celia, what are your thoughts on this?
So in terms of solidarity, there are As we know, existing regional human rights organizations and the allied groups or formations that deal with enforced disappearance, such as AFAD, and they need to be both strengthened and expanded. They should be supported by similar organizations. And then the meta-legal activities that I mentioned earlier, such as the fora, the conferences, the focus group discussions, these may be conducted jointly or at least bilaterally with organizations and groups from across Asia. So we can coordinate and do this so that the member organizations are not alone in conducting them. And then the mass mobilizations, these may also be conducted simultaneously, like it's happening all at the same time in different countries, let's say in Laos, in Thailand, in Indonesia, in Timor-Leste, here in Manila, especially when done in protest or in commemoration of the annual red letter days relevant to enforced disappearance, such as the International Day of the Victims of Enforced Disappearance on August 30 every year and the International Week of the Disappeared on the last week of May. Also, engaging the media is critical in order to reach the widest audience possible. So I truly appreciate New Narrative, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for this podcast. And may I also take this chance to encourage listeners, if you or anyone you know are a victim of enforced disappearance, or if you would like to support the cause of putting an end to enforced disappearance, you may contact concerned human rights groups such as AFAD and its member organizations. So I have already mentioned the member organization here in the Philippines, FIND. Then we have two in Indonesia, one mentioned by Wulan, ICOHI, and then there's CONTRAS. Then we have the HAC Association in Timor-Leste. In Thailand, we also have two, Justice for Peace Foundation and the Relatives Committee of the May 1992 Heroes. In Sri Lanka, we have the Families of the Disappeared, ODHIKAR in Bangladesh, Defense of Human Rights in Pakistan, the Association of Parents of Disappeared Persons in India-administered Jammu and Kashmir, also two organizations in Nepal, Advocacy Forum and the Conflict Victim Society for Justice. And then in South Korea, we have the Citizens Alliance for North Korean Human Rights. So do feel free to approach AFAD and the member organizations I just mentioned for help if you need it or to help if you want to. Yeah, so thank you.
And that wraps up our discussion with Wulan Kusuma-Wardani and Celia Sevilla. The International Convention for the Protection of All Persons of Enforced Disappearance currently lists 72 organizations and 98 signatories, which is a good start, but we really need strong civil movements to hold people accountable for this and make a change. If you have a friend or family member who's fallen victim to enforced disappearance, or if you would simply like to reach out to help, here are the organizations you can contact once again. FINE in the Philippines, ICOHI in Indonesia, CONTRAS in Indonesia, HAC Association in Timor-Leste, Justice for Peace Foundation in Thailand, and Relatives Committee of the May 1992 Heroes in Thailand. We'll have the list up on our show notes on the website as well. My name is Bonibel Rambatan, and this has been Southeast Asia Dispatches, brought to you by New Narrative and produced by Daniel Anugrah. I'll see you around.